For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, lawmakers at the state capitol reach a stalemate over the budget as House Speaker Charles McCall suspended the special session until an agreement can be reached on how to fund the government. Neva, where do things go from here?
Good question. I think we probably need to ask Speaker McCall that. We're at the same place we were talking last week and the week before and the week before. And until folks can come up with a plan that they can get the number of votes that they need, I mean, this train's not leaving the station. And I think it's one of those situations where lawmakers, I think, are growing increasingly frustrated with the process and the inability to try to get some sort of a deal. And this idea of some grand deal being struck, some grand bargain, just doesn't seem to be in the making. And I think when you look at even the cigarette tax, I mean, it's clear that the House Republicans cannot get there without Democrat votes coming across and joining in. And at this point, that just seems to be where the biggest part of the stalemate is. I mean, so we'll see whether they can work through the weekend. They are going to continue to work, as I understand it, on all sides to try to come up with something. The pressure continues to build, but at this moment, I don't think we have any kind of realistic timetable on where they can get to an actual vote and get a deal done.
Ryan.
Yeah, I think you've got a lot of folks coming to the Governor Mary Fallon met 2.5 hours with the Republican caucus this week. She met with the Democratic caucus in the House. I think she's meeting with Senate leaders if she hasn't already. And you've got Senate Republicans saying that they want to put a fuel tax on the table. House Democrats saying, hey, listen, we'll come to the table on the cigarette tax, but you've got to have something else there. Most notably, the gross production tax rate. Raising the gross production tax to its historic level of 7% or some compromise thereabouts. And so you've got all of these people, I think, that are coming together and saying, you know, there are ways that we can reach consensus. And there seems to be one individual that's stopping all of that progress, and that's Speaker Charles McCall. He has said that gross production tax is off the table. He is, I think, in a position right now where he knows that he doesn't have the votes in his membership. You know, he has fewer votes for the cigarette tax now than he did back in the regular session, it appears. And the votes that he does have that he's boasting about, even those don't seem all that certain. Leader Inman, the Democratic Minority Leader Inman, Scott Inman, said earlier this week that if Charles McCall, if the speaker had those votes, he'd put them up on the board. And I think that that's exactly right. And so you've got a speaker who is committed to not allowing anything other than a cigarette tax to come out of this special session. And I think that that's the very definition of compromise here is that if you're going to reach any sort of consensus, you've got to put something on the table to bring new votes. And he doesn't seem willing to do that.
And I think while that may seem to be the case today, the reality is at some point, everyone's going to have to give. I mean, someone's going to have to blink. Someone's going to have to back up and do what they don't want to do. And I think that's where we're waiting for that moment in time to occur and what that will look like. And, you know, as I've said before, they shouldn't be trying to fight the big battles of the next session in a special session. They have a specific agenda and a specific kind of focus that needs to be targeted. They need to address that and go home. And I think that's really, I mean, what I hear many of the lawmakers saying when they're back in their districts at the coffee shop or at church or at the ball game with their kids, that's what they're hearing from just the regular Oklahoma voter who is saying, hey, just get this thing done and move on. And so I think they're complicating it with all of these other mixes of questions and problems of right-sizing or downsizing or increasing taxes or all of the mix that is just not going to get where they need to go on this short-term question.
But, you know, if they want to pass the cigarette tax and they want to pass it in a constitutional way, which requires the supermajorities in both chambers, according to the Oklahoma Constitution, they knew back in the spring and they know now that if they're going to get Democratic votes on that, they've got to have something else out there. That dynamic hasn't changed. And so I think that if the speaker doesn't even have to pass, but I think if the speaker would put a gross production tax measure on the table and allow it to come up for a vote, allow it to move through the committee process, that he would get some movement from Democrats on the cigarette tax here. And I think that his reluctance to do that, I think, is going to push us into a
real
position.
And that may well come. I wouldn't totally rule that out as still a possibility. I think it's just been this intractable nature of all of the parties. I mean, clearly, the Democrats have shored up and said they're not going to break ranks. Republicans are inside their caucus. Clearly, when you listen, they're splintered and they can't come up with 51 or 76 in helping to get either one of those numbers to be a reality. And we'll just see how long this drags on.
And anything can happen before we meet next week. Starting next week, the Oklahoma Department of Corrections is starting a program to reduce prison overcrowding. Under the program, DOC would release nonviolent criminals who have only 18 months left in their sentence. But it's getting pushed back from the very lawmaker who managed this past session to derail efforts to reduce prison overcrowding. Chickasha Republican Representative Scott Biggs claims the program endangers the public. Ryan, your thoughts on this pushback?
It's more ridiculous rhetoric out of Representative Biggs. And at the outset here, let's be clear. Representative Biggs is one of 101 members of the Oklahoma House of Representatives. He has the power that he has over criminal justice reform in the state of Oklahoma because of one person, the same person that we were talking about just a moment ago, Speaker Charles McCall. Speaker Charles McCall is interested in seeing criminal justice reform measures move their way through the Oklahoma legislature. He has to remove Scott Biggs from this position of power, where he has both a platform to speak out against just common sense measures, the ones like the ones Director Albaugh is taking here, and the legislative proposals that are coming in front of his committee. Director Albaugh is just doing what he has to do. We have over 60,000 people in the Department of Corrections custody right now. It is a crisis in and of itself. But it is what we're about to see, I think, in the next year, if something doesn't happen, is going to be something that Oklahoma hasn't seen ever. You know, we're talking about the danger posed to both inmates, the danger posed to prison staff, the danger posed to the community, and it's just unsustainable. It's unconscionable what we've got going on right now. You know, the program that they're talking, these folks are going to be out in 18 months. I mean, so we're not talking about people that are 18 years away from getting out. And what's so interesting in the way that Representative Biggs thinks about this is that he just basically wants these people to sit in there forever. I mean, that's what's really being revealed here, is that he thinks that once somebody's done some sort of crime, that they should just be in there forever, because these are folks that are going to be out in 18 months anyways, that we wouldn't give them a very strict community supervision program, get them out of these facilities. It just doesn't make sense.
Neva, the Republicans have always been an idea of tough on crime. Is Biggs maybe taking it a little too far?
Well, I think in the minds of many folks, I think that is true. And I think the points that Ryan mentions are, I think, at the core of what needs to be discussed here. I mean, we have a situation where we have prison overcrowding, we have all of these issues, we have the complication of the budget factor in it, and yet what is being talked about specifically here is the early release with 18 months left on their time of about 1,400 inmates, 1,400 out of 60,000, and yet this explodes into, again, this ongoing debate and a bully pulpit for one person to try to champion his own cause. And I think it really doesn't lend well to the bigger issue, and it certainly makes it very difficult for Director Albaugh and all of the folks at DOC that are on the front lines working there every day to try to deal with what is a growing, very difficult situation that we've talked about many times even on this program. So I think to let him go unchecked and to let this continue is regrettable, because again, this is one of those issues that if they want to change the statutes, if they want to deal with these issues in some other way, there's a time and a process to do that. By the same token, we had state questions on the ballot last time, where Oklahomans clearly spoke their will and wishes. And so this is something that's not going to go away, whether Representative Biggs is chair of a committee or even in the Oklahoma legislature. And I think we have to look at the long-term big view on this and get some real resolution on how we are going to go as a state and quit just playing the politics of it at the lowest base level.
And if Biggs wants to see the legislature have greater oversight into how DOC is going to do something like this, then stop obstructing reforms. Get out of the way of progress. You know, he is the mouthpiece for the district attorneys and the District Attorneys Association, and they are in the business of preserving the status quo because that's the world in which they live. They can't see anything outside of that. And the 1,400 inmates, Neva, that's an incredibly small number, but it's probably going to be an even smaller number of that. That's the 1,400 that are eligible for consideration. So it'll be an even smaller number than that would be ultimately released in these community supervision programs. And Representative Biggs wants to make it out to be Sodom and Gomorrah.
And the other element of this is what you just mentioned, bringing in the district attorneys into this mix, is here's a situation where you have a lot of stakeholders, a lot of interests at the table that all have a role, all have something that they are mandated to do, and they have those specific roles. And now what we have is the inability to get everyone together and say, how can we work through this? I mean, there's some legitimate issues on all sides, but right now it's this intractable nature of either or, and I think the public is just growing more and more and more negative on the whole process as a result of it.
And if the public wants to direct their attention somewhere, it's to these district attorneys. They are the largest single impediment to criminal justice reform in the state of Oklahoma. They are elected officials.
But even at that, I think, again, that's a blanket assessment that, you know, the voters in these individual districts, I mean, rather than just kind of making this blanket assertion on all of them, I think what they have to do is determine with each individual district attorney where they are on these issues and let them have an opportunity to work through that and communicate that to the voters that are ultimately are going to be responsible for electing them or not.
Which would go to your form. If you've got a district attorney, well, everyone has a district attorney, yeah, and they're voting, go to your district attorney and find out their position.
And try to get them to be held accountable at the ballot box. What happens right now is that DAs will often resign. This just happened earlier this week. DAs resign, that the governor gets to appoint usually an assistant district attorney, and so we have these incumbents that come into office without an election. This happens all the time.
It's happened since time began, though.
We've got to change that.
Yeah, incumbency in Oklahoma is certainly a
thing. In America.
Yeah. A former Oklahoma Attorney General and now head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, is installing a soundproof communication booth at his office. The cost to install this will run up to $25,000. Neva, why do you think Pruitt needs a soundproof phone booth?
Well, I don't know, but as I understand it, at EPA, they had the same sort of thing. They just didn't have it in his particular office suite of the administrator. So the idea that somehow he's come up with this great new idea that he's going to have his private phone booth, so to speak, I think may be a stretch. And I think, again, it's part of the give and take of a EPA administrator who is highly polarizing out there on the political landscape. And he's always going to, anything he does that they think there's any room to shoot at, I mean, he's going to be a prime target, I think, throughout the course of his time in that role. And so I think in some measure, this may be more smoke than anything else, but I'm sure that Ryan may have a different opinion about that.
Maybe. Ryan, do you have a different opinion than that?
You know, the only phone booth I know that's worth $25,000 ought to travel through time.
It should be the TARDIS.
Scott Pruitt now thinks he's Doctor Who and needs a telephone booth in his office. This is a real bargain, though. I mean, he's getting a telephone booth for $25,000. I mean, this is the same guy who paid $14,000 for a round-trip flight between Tulsa and Guymon. So, I mean, $25,000 for a phone booth. I think that, he's the guy who looks at the in-flight magazine on the plane and says, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I'll pay this much money for a phone booth. In reality, what this is that it demonstrates both the ostentatious nature in which he has approached this position and his own sense of his own inflated sense of self. But more importantly, it's this pattern of a lack of transparency, him wanting to. It's either paranoia or it's this commitment to keeping people from having access to what it is that he is doing and saying as an official member of the United States government. He has, if you look at the Washington Post story that reported this, it said that he has reduced the number of emails that he's using. Well, that's not because he doesn't like email. I hate email too. I've reduced the number of emails that I use as well. But I think that he's done it because it creates a paper trail. It makes him subject to Freedom of Information Request Act request. It makes him subject to open records requests that we've seen here in Oklahoma that currently and pending litigation with Center for Media and Democracy against Director Pruitt. And so this is, you know, this is just this pattern of somebody who's non-transparent. He's having face-to-face conversations more and more now so that there's less to be reported whenever these requests are made. Here's somebody who has committed his professional career to defying transparency.
And it still begs the question, why would any elected official need to have a soundproof phone system of any kind? I mean, if a lawmaker decided to have a soundproof in their office at the Capitol, why do you need that?
Well, I mean, I think Scott Pruitt would probably have to be the one to answer that. But I think the bigger issue, I mean, when you talk about should someone have emails or should it be face-to-face conversation, should it be more verbal or should it be more written? I mean, those things are to be determined by the person who is in that position. I mean, I think we can all sit and take pot shots out there and say this person should, give us a paper trail, and if we don't like that person, we can pile on. Or conversely, if this is someone we really like and we like what they're doing, then that just kind of gives us the reinforcement to have all of the information to really lay it out there and be supportive. And again, I mean, this is about the changing of the guard and the changing of the way the Environmental Protection Agency is going to do business under this administration. And there are a lot of folks that certainly don't like that change and don't want to see the things take place that are already moving forward. And so, I think we're going to have this constant attack on Scott Pruitt throughout his time there, because I mean, he is the focus of everything that really the previous administration and many that championed a lot of the issues that Republicans are totally counter on. So I mean, it's a case of who's in charge, and if folks don't like it, they'll have to continue not to like it and continue to shoot at the people that are the messengers and the people that are going to deliver the changes. But the bottom line is that's just the give and take of politics at the national level.
The lack of transparency creates a threat to democracy. Both
lack of transparency in whose eyes? I mean,
I think that if you look at you can just compare the EPA under the Obama administration to the EPA under the Trump administration, and the transparency is very different. And so, I mean, I think that both contemporaneously, we need to be able to hold our elected and appointed officials accountable. And the way that we do that in a measured way is through a record. And if you don't have that record, it's difficult to do. And then historically, and whether it's 10, 15, 20, or 100 years from now, we're not going to have accounts of these face-to-face encounters. We're not going to have accounts of these phone calls that were made in the $25,000 phone booth that weren't recorded. You know, we're not going to have that for posterity
to
be able to say,
not going to be a paper trail, to suggest that there's not going to be a clear documentation of what's going on in any agency or any department in the federal government under any administration, I think is preposterous. I
mean, it's the truth
is,
there.
It is what it is, and there are rules and formats set in place that, frankly, much of that's dictated by Congress.
He went with
so they're going to make sure that there is a sufficient paper trail and make sure there's sufficient communication to know what's going on, who's being responsible for it, what's getting done, what's not getting done, and I think that process has always been there, regardless of whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration.
And thank goodness that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and others have been doing their best to hold Scott Pruitt accountable in this position. You know, here's a guy who, but even then, he has either defied, refused to answer, and in some instances outright lied to Congress over the request that they've made. He has refused to give over itinerary dates and meeting dates for months on end, and only gave them after a Freedom of Information request. So the lack of transparency here, I think, is troubling, and it is a departure from previous administrations.
The leader of the state Senate Democrats is getting criticism for possible conflict of interest. Senator John Sparks is providing legal representation to several pharmaceutical companies which are facing a lawsuit over opioid abuse by the state of Oklahoma. Ryan, is this a conflict of interest?
Yeah, I think that it's one that deserves to be looked at. I think any time that an issue of a conflict arises, especially in a legal context, everybody ought to be looking at it and trying to figure out, is it something that is an actual conflict? Is it one that can be overcome? Can you make disclosures and have everyone agree that the conflict exists and then still move forward? So folks should look into it. I do think that at the outset, a few things that have popped out to me is that, one, there's no unified state policy on the opioid litigation. The Attorney General holds the position that these pharmaceutical companies are responsible for the ills of the opioid addiction. He has to prove that to the courts, and then ultimately he's a political actor himself. He has to prove that to the voters. A state senator has the right to disagree with that position, and a senator can rally members against that position in the legislature. They can use their platform to argue that the voters should reject the policy of the AG, and if they're lawyers, they can weigh in on the litigation. So in a system of separation of powers, one branch can't unilaterally squelch the voice of another or members of another. Now, where there might be a conflict that could come up, both ethical and legislative, would be in the instance that Sparks was called upon to vote on something that would directly impact one of these pharmaceutical companies. I think in that instance, disclosure and transparency is required, and he may have to step away from any sort of a vote that would have an impact there, because he's presumably getting paid by these pharmaceutical companies. And if he's doing something that would benefit them, or where even the appearance of impropriety or an appearance of conflict could persuade or the outcome of his vote or how he might vote, you know, he needs to step away from that.
And certainly that would be considered like bribery, something like that, because if you got a job, basically, and they're paying you for it. But do you think this is a conflict of interest, Neva?
Well, I'm like Ryan. I mean, I think this is something, a question's been raised. I mean, I think there's a lot of give and take on both sides, and there are some things probably in the background that are precipitating this. I mean, when you look at the drug companies that we're talking about, that the state of Oklahoma is going after, I mean, they've asked a Cleveland County district judge basically to issue a protective order, which would prevent the AG's office from gathering information until at least a discovery process, until the court rules on whether or not to dismiss this case. So I think, you know, John Sparks, senator from Cleveland County, I think there's some politics in this, as well as just the legal back and forth. And when you look at all of the people that have been asked, the Bar Association, they've said, you know, we don't know. We can't say right now. Ethics Commission, is this a problem? We don't know. We can't say right now. So, I mean, I think it's one of those things where they fire the volley out there. They kind of, you know, set the stage, but there may be much more about it in terms of just the political and legal maneuvering behind the scenes.
I mean, if the actual conflict existed, if Senator Sparks or any senator spoke out against the litigation, if a state senator all of a sudden has an obligation to an ethical obligation to the state's clients or the state's legal interest, if they speak out against it, you know, then they are doing a disservice to their client. And so I think that line of argument doesn't hold a whole lot of water, but it's still worth looking into. I mean, anytime you've got a prominent state senator sitting in a courtroom in their own district on a big case that the state's weighed into, look into it. I don't think that there's anything here that should preclude Senator Sparks from continuing to represent them in this matter.
And I think basically people in his own law firm, that was their assertion, is look, I mean, we have, you can have a lawmaker who's also an attorney who can be representing someone in a case versus the state of Oklahoma, as it would read, and they have a perfectly legitimate right to do that as part of their part of their duties and profession outside the scope of being a legislator. So I would agree with you,
but
Ryan, at this point.
Where the line would be crossed is if they were trying to like pass a law against these opioid companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah, then he would have to, because, I mean, just like with any legislator that's getting paid by, that's on the payroll, not in any nefarious way, but just getting paid by some industry that then, you know, has legislation that is in front of the legislature, they have to step away from it. They have to take a constitutional privilege and not vote.
Gubernatorial candidate Gary Richardson is donating $1 million to his own campaign. The Tulsa businessman says he's donating to his own campaign so he isn't beholden to special interest groups. Neva, what do you think about Richardson's decision?
I think it's not surprising. He spent $2 million of his own money back in 2002 when he ran for governor as an independent. I mean, it was clear he was going to be a largely self-funding candidate. And I think when we see these large statewide races, I mean, oftentimes that's the case. I mean, you have individuals who are able and willing to put a significant amount of their own personal money in addition to fundraising and bringing other people along. So, I think what's fascinating as the Republican primary is developing is that really we have six candidates in the race on the Republican side, two potentially self-funders. I mean, so far. I mean, we have Kevin Stitt from Tulsa, who is a self-made millionaire mortgage banker who has an exceptionally good profile on paper. If you're looking at, you know, starting to handicap all of these six, who is kind of someone coming out of nowhere, has not been on the political scene, but has said he has the financial wherewithal to engage in this race and wants to be, you know, wants to have kind of a framework for his campaign of, you know, wanting to turn the state around, which is kind of the same message we're hearing from Gary Richardson. And then you have, Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett and the Auditor Inspector Gary Jones, Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb, former State Representative Dan Fisher. It's an interesting field. And when you start talking about primary politics, whether we're talking on the Democratic side or the Republican side, it becomes a very fascinating political landscape to navigate. So I think this sets up for, one of the most interesting political seasons on the statewide level that we've seen in many, many years.
Ryan, I do want to ask you, how concerning is it? Because if the only way to run for governor is to basically be self-funded, then you can't have just your average normal guy on the street have any kind of chance of competing in this.
Now, here's the good news. The research around campaigns that continues to come out, and there's a report that was recently published, I think the last month, that talked about the persuasive effect of all types of media, everything from television to direct mail to online, whatever the persuasive effect is near zero. And so what it really comes down to is how you spend this money. So you can have all the money in the world, mm-hmm. but if you don't spend it the right way, I mean, Donald Trump, the guy, I don't think he spent a dollar on TV advertisements, or if he did, it was a dollar to, the ratio was 1 to 10,000, right? And he's in the White House right now. Mm-hmm. The idea that the way that money gets spent in these campaigns that have made a lot of people very rich, in particular people that buy ads for TV markets, the research just doesn't back up that's where the money is best used. Now, in a primary like this up front, everybody's going to be fighting for name recognition and creating some sort of image around themselves. Gary Richardson, he's not going to be able to bank on the name that he built for himself back in 2002. Folks aren't going to remember that. That's not going to be on their radar. So they're going to have to build some new name recognition, some new branding around who they are as candidates. But beyond that, micro-targeting with very small audiences of voters, getting them to the polls, getting a strong, solid field operation that's identifying who your voters are, not persuading people, but identifying people that are organically going to support you and making sure that they show up on election day. That's the real key here. And the good news is that on a scale of campaign expenses, that type of work, if you do it the right way, is vastly less expensive than spending millions on TV
television,
ads.
Radio. And the best way to politic out there is go out and meet people. Go
absolutely.
To town hall meetings,
and I think when we always talk about the fundraising, somehow that kind of gets painted with this sinister brush always. I mean, like there's something wrong with people investing in the political process, whether they do it personally as a candidate or whether they do it as an individual wanting to support a candidate. And really successful campaigns, when you look at them at the end of it all, it's a combination of both of those things. I mean, it's the investment of time and energy and maybe money to some degree by the candidate, and then all of those same things multiplied many times on the part of the voters out there who are deciding who is the best person they want to see elected.
Mostly going out there and meeting the voters and
having
your voice heard.
Good field will beat a big media campaign with everything else being equal any day of the week.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.